Morning. Pretty big crowd for Easter. So, as human beings, we believe the knowledge of ourselves is important. Other creatures love, and they laugh, and they talk, and they think. We reflect, and there may be some other beings that reflect too, but we really reflect. We think about thinking. We know that we know. And this can lead to vicious circles, vicious cycles, right? And confusions if it's improperly matched. But it also can give depth and volume to what would otherwise be pretty shallow, pretty flat. So we're reflective. Human beings are reflective. And we want to know what makes us tick. We're fascinated and frustrated by the fact that our own selves are the most difficult to know. We're very, very complex. Very complex beings, aren't we? And in the last couple of talks that I've given, I've been reflecting on the self. So that's interesting. That's interesting. From a Western psychological point of view, as I think I talked about last time or the time before, if we look at psychology from Freud up to now, we can simplify it as reflection on the inner child, the inner parent, and the arbiter between the two. The arbiter between the two. Little Tim, who's always needy, who always wants more candy and more support and more love and more admiration and more everything, right? Wah. And the internal parent who says, all right, now, stay in line, right? And then the arbiter, the ego, that's running back and forth between the two, trying to just have some peace, have a little peace. And my example from this last week, I always have these examples come up in my life. I just assume they not come up. But here they go. Here they are. So I was sick last weekend. I had to miss a wonderful workshop here, and I was not here on Sunday. Well, the week before, I think I only had about two cookies. Only two. Only two, and I got them at the Wedge. Healthy cookies. And maybe I had one cup of decaf coffee and another cup of half-calf coffee. That's all I did. And I was sick for the whole weekend. So my child got out of control. And the parent had to, Big Tim, Daddy Tim, Tim's daddy in here, had to say, well, no, this next week, come on, tighten up. So this is what we are dealing with as human beings, and it's good to be able to reflect on this, to reflect on it, to stand back and reflect, so then we're not just consumed by it and carried away by it. And Katagiri Roshi, the guiding teacher here, said to me once, why do Americans not like themselves? That's interesting. Because our inner parent so often becomes an inner tyrant, so often becomes tyrannical. And I think he must have heard person after person come up and sort of cry to him about how they were beating themselves up. And he thought, oh, this is an American custom? Well, I don't know, but we need to pay attention to this. The inner parent is not supposed to be a tyrant. The inner parent is to help us self-regulate our little needy child. So, pay attention. Pay attention. And I said to Katagiri, I don't know why. I didn't even know. I don't know anything about Japanese culture either. So, I don't know why. I did point out to him that there were a lot of ex-Catholics at Zen Center. He said, well, what's that mean? I didn't get into it with him. But you know what that means. And then if we, so that's the popularization of Freud to the present time, popularization of Jung, who was Freud's buddy and then his not buddy. That's the way it goes, you know. the simplest popularization is Myers-Briggs profile. Raise your hand if you know Myers-Briggs profile. Oh, almost everybody. Wow. It's still, some people still use it, yeah. Uh-huh. So it's good to, that's another way to reflect. That's another way to reflect on our patterns. And I'm not going to spend much time on it, but I am an ENTP. And which is cool. I like being an ENTP. but there are two components that get me in trouble in my ENTP. Maybe there are more than that. But two in particular that consistently get pointed out to me. And is intuitive. I make decisions intuitively. I think intuitively. I make decisions intuitively. And the last one is P. Perception means that either you can, if you don't like peas, you say, oh, they change their minds all the time. If you like them, you say, oh, they're open to everything that changes. So I change my mind a lot, and I'm intuitive. So that just, that messes people up. It doesn't mess me up, but when I see that they're messed up, I do get messed up. So I have to monitor. I have to reflect. And I can reflect. I can see these patterns. Sometimes it's too late, but it's actually never too late. You can always apologize, right? So I have a reputation, maybe not here, but in my other community I had a reputation for being impulsive. But I never thought I was impulsive. I'm just intuitive and open to things as they change. But part of reflection is seeing how we appear to others and how we can support others and how we hurt others and how we can avoid it if we pay attention. And then, of course, the other example I gave last week, if I talked last week or the week before, whenever I talked, was in practice period now, they're doing the six realms. And the last time Ted told me they were doing the fighting spirit. These are six psychological realms from Buddhist thought that we tend to fall into. We tend to move around between. And we have default realms too, right? And so Ted told me they were doing the fighting titan. You guys are calling it Titan. Well, I call it Spirit. But the Fighting Titan realm. And I said, oh, Ted, that's my default realm. And he just looked at me because he knows already. He knows. So we need to know these things about ourselves. We need to know these. So this ability to be reflective can support our practice, can support our lives, can support our attempt to work and play in a meaningful, loving way with each other. And we have to accept our patterns and then try to adjust them. Accept our patterns and try to adjust them. And then accept them some more when they don't get very well adjusted. And then try to adjust them some more. key to Zen practice, key to living. So that's the reflective. But then in Zen meditation, we also have the pre-reflective. So Dogen is the main man in Soto Zen, the main man. In his treatise on meditation, Fukan Zazengi, he talks about how you hold the body, where you put your tongue, where you put your eyes, where you put your shoulders. But you keep waiting for the meditation instruction. You keep waiting. How is he going to instruct you about the mind, about the self? And finally he says, think non-thinking. How do you think non-thinking? Be before thinking. These are the basics of Zazen, period. So that's the pre-reflective, and it can piss people off when they read it. They want more help. They're reflecting on themselves. They want help. They want support. But he's encouraging us to return to the pre-reflective. So within our reflections, we generally think the six senses, and there are six senses in Buddhism. There are the five senses, and then there's the thinking organ and thought. That's the sixth sense. Within the six senses, taken together, that covers all experience, the whole of experience. And our knowledge of facts and events are everything. But in meditation, we have the opportunity to tap into the pre-reflective, to the awareness of the gaps between my fingers, between the gaps between our senses, the gaps between our thoughts. And these gaps, there's darkness. It's pre-reflective. It's pre-reflective. There's darkness. And that darkness is scary. It's scary. It makes us anxious. We want to get back to our thinking. But that's also where we discover our Buddha nature, our still nature, our calm nature, our nature that's open and available to whatever is happening. Open and available to whatever is happening. And I often say it only takes this much of a gap between a thought. Nobody's thoughts are going so fast that they can't experience a gap. And within that gap, there's a whole universe. A whole universe. The whole universe. So Dogen, who's also, I already said Dogen's our main man in Soto Zen. I'm getting to like him better than I used to, frankly. I heard he was a main man years ago, but I thought, he's confusing. He's so into his ritual. And I'm getting to like him better. Maybe I'm just getting older. Anyway, he's my main man, supposedly, in my tradition, so I better like him. That's what my internal parent says. You like him, Tim. You like him. And I won't tell you what my internal child says. Because it's Easter Sunday. Dogen talks about whole being Buddha nature, which really includes both the pre-reflective and the reflective, whole being Buddha nature. So Dogen takes the Maha Parinirvana Sutra, a text from early Mahayana, where it says, beings all have Buddha nature, meaning beings all have still place within them. Before they reflect, which is open to the wonder of living, the wonder of being. They all have that. They all have that. But Dogen takes the Sino-Japanese characters, and instead of saying beings all have Buddha nature, he translates it shitsu as whole being rather than as all have. So rather than beings all have Buddha nature, it's beings whole being Buddha nature. Beings whole being Buddha nature. So he's eliminated the separation inherent in a subject possessing an object. And there's great relief when you discover this, that you don't need to possess anything. Because within whole being Buddha nature, you've already got it. You've already got it. You're lucky on this Easter Sunday. You are lucky. You've already got it. And there can be great relief. Great relief when you discover this truth. So I got a book in the mail about 4 or 5 days ago, which is a book by Tygen Layton, who is a Zen teacher who lives in Chicago. And it's a book he's just put out on the teachings of Dongshan. Dongshan, Dongshan. And so I was happy to get it, and I emailed him and thanked him. And I opened the book, and the dedication was to his teacher, Reb Anderson, his teacher, whom he got transmission from. That means he finished his apprenticeship, so to speak, about 20, 25 years ago, I don't know. And so in his dedication to his teacher, he said, he quoted Dongshan, and he said, "He is no other than me, but I am not him, and I'm very grateful." That was his dedication. "He is no other than me, but I am not him." And here's the story about Dongshan. Dongshan, when he made this statement. Dongshan left his teacher, Yunyuan, after practicing with him for a while, and was perplexed. He didn't quite get it. As he proceeded, he was wading across a stream and seeing his reflection in the water. He looked down in the stream and had a huge opening to non-thinking. And then he wrote this poem. "Just don't seek from others, or you'll be far estranged from yourself. Now I walk alone, but everywhere I meet it. It is now me, I am now it. One must understand in this way to emerge with suchness. So today I walk alone as a reflected being." I'm alone as a reflected being. We're alone. Completely alone. "But everywhere we meet each other in our pre-reflection. Everywhere we meet each other. All being Buddha nature. All being Buddha nature." So that's what Tygen said about his teacher Reb, who's giving a talk here on such and such a day. Let's see, April 28th. Okay. "He is no other than me, but I am not him." Thank you. So I also have a book coming out. Most of you know about that. Actually, if you go online, you can order it right now. It's not you can't get it in bookstores yet, but it's a book of my talks over the years, which have been compiled and edited by Wanda Isle in a very very wonderful way. Wonderful way. So much so that when I read it, I think, "Oh, that's wise." I better go see her. Maybe she'll be my teacher. And it's called Nothing Holy About It. And then the sub title is The Zen of Being Who You Are. So, the more we completely embrace who we are in the open-hearted, pre-reflective mode of thinking, the more we can really be reflective about ourselves and the world around us and not get tangled up in the reflection, but really use the reflection to support ourselves, to support others. So, also, what's happening right now is that today we're having a little, during coffee tea hour, we're going to have a cake, and we're congratulating three priests here, three of my students, who are getting transmission from me, who have gotten transmission from me, Friday. So those are Ben Connolly, who's upstairs teaching Intro to Zazen, Wanda Isle, and Busho Lon. So now they've finished their apprenticeship with me. Now they have the opportunity to live this, whole Buddha, being Buddha nature. Of course, we're always apprentices our whole lives. We're apprentices to whole being Buddha nature. But we're within it. It's not something out there. Or it's within us. I don't know. Whatever you want to say. To be before thinking and to still embrace our thinking. All of us. Not just them. All of us. That's Zen practice. Now, each of us can return to and manifest whole being Buddha nature, but we don't actually have to return to it because we already are it. But in our reflective mind, we think we need to return. That's fine. Reflecting on the way that we do, we can keep a Zazen practice going and what the distractions are, and how to deal with the internal tyrant, and how to take care of the little baby inside that always wants more milk, more love. Right? And it's our lifetime apprenticeship. So within whole being Buddha nature, as we reflect, we see that self and other, subject and object, me and you, organism and environment, are the poles of a single process. We can explain it that way, and we can tell the people on the third floor about that, and they think, oh, cool. And that's our reflection. That's good. We reflect. That's cool. We should be reflecting. But as we pre-reflect, we can appreciate the Upanishads. That is the self. That is the real. Thou art that. This is the self. This is the real. Thou art this. That's the pre-reflective. So, whole being Buddha nature is so much more yourself than just your existence. You can't make it an object. There's no way to stand outside this. And no need to do so. So long as I'm trying to grasp this, I'm implying that this is not really myself. What a relief when I realize that it is. What a relief. And of course, our block is the ingrained and compelling myth that the I comes into this world or is thrown out from it in such a way as to have no essential connection to it. No more than a temporary stranger, a visitor who hardly belongs. A lot of people feel that way. Actually, I felt that way before. Before I started Zen for a long time. And even during Zen for a long time. Isolated and lonely. Isolated and lonely human beings are when we're caught by our reflective mode. Isolated and lonely. So we create God. We create gods. We create Buddha. We create Buddhas. We create gurus. We create heavens. We create hells. We create reincarnation. We do all that stuff because we're lonely. And within our reflection, we want something. So that's fine. That's fine that we do that. Just what we do. Not bad. It's part of whole being Buddha nature. Seems to be human, the way humans are. The way humans are. And then, of course, we fight about which one's right. That's the way humans are, too. My goodness. We could kill gazillions of people. But I'm not going to get into that on Easter Sunday. You know that pretty well. You know that. That's reflection gone berserk. And then hanging on to one specific reflection as being the right reflection. This is it, the right one. I said I wasn't going to talk about this, but I guess I am. In Sri Lanka, what the Buddhists have done to the Tamils is just awful. They brought the Hindus in, the Hindu Tamils in, to work on do the tea, to be the manual laborers in the tea fields. And then what did the Buddhists do to them? The Tamils rose up. They said, we want to be treated like equals. We have a right to live. And the Buddhists massacred them. So be careful. As soon as you glom onto one reflection that you think's right, reflect on that. That's what your reflective sense is for, so you can step back and reflect on it. Accept your how attached you are, and then notice the possibility of letting go and just returning back to pre-reflection, to stillness. That's always here. That's always available. So, Busho Lawn, Ben Connolly up on the third floor, up in the heaven realm, and Wanda Isle. I have been reflecting on them for, I don't know, 6, 8, 10, 12 years. They can tell me how long it's been. I've been watching them and trying to support them, trying to help them, sometimes doing a pretty good job, sometimes not doing too good a job. And giving them opportunities to mentor themselves and then mentor others. And I'm happy that they've developed the ability to live within both the pre-reflective and the reflective modes, which we can all do. We can all do. So, in the pre-reflective mode, again, Zazen, that's our meditation, Zen meditation, non-thinking, with a very little technique. If we follow Dogen, it's all our only technique is to sit up straight and cross our legs, which I can't even do anymore, and then think non-thinking, of course. Which is before thinking, in case you didn't get that. So the Zazen practice that we do gives us the opportunity to respond to the world with freshness, because in those gaps between our thoughts, we see everything for the first time. We see everything for the very first time. Continually. And that's the pre-reflective, right? But we can also be reflective. We can notice when we're being impulsive. Maybe our wife has to tell us. That's okay. That's what we have a wife for, or a husband, or, you know. Oh, I'm being impulsive. No, no, Linda, that's not impulsive. That's my auntie. You know, we argue, right? Dogen also talks about entwined vines. He talks about the relationship between a teacher and a student as one of entwined vines. We do. We get entwined. So we just watch that. We work with it. We play with it. And then we're able to distance ourselves from our patterns and sometimes modify sometimes. So I want to close by talking about actually probably my first inspiration as a Zen teacher, although it might say something different in the book. So, you know, Wanda wrote the book, so if it says something different in the book, talk to her. My first inspiration as a Zen teacher, more or less, was a book. I had non-Zen books too, but a book called Zen and English Literature and Oriental Classics by R.H. Blyth. And I thought it was, I still have it, it's barely together. R.H. Blyth had practiced Zen in Korea and then in Japan, and he was actually, and it was very early on. And after he'd been in Japan teaching for a while, World War II broke out, and he was interned in an internment camp. And while he was in that camp, he met a really young guy. I think you and I were talking about this, Jeff. He met a really young guy named Robert Aiken. And Robert Aiken had never heard of this Zen stuff, but he was taken with Blyth. And so R.H. Blyth taught Robert Aiken how to sit while they were in jail in the internment camp. There wasn't too much opportunity for it. So he was an important person to me, as Robert Aiken was, who is dead now too. Anyway, these are all old people, long gone. But anyway, R.H. Blyth, in his book Zen and English Literature and Oriental Classics, dedicated that book to D.T. Suzuki, which was the first Suzuki, not my teacher Suzuki, the first Suzuki to bring Zen to America. And he said in his dedication, and I was really puzzled when I read it back then, he said, I dedicate this book to D.T. Suzuki, who taught me everything. And then there was a long space, and then he said that I don't know. So the reflective teaching, we need to use our reflective ability to teach people, to work with them, to help ourselves. Pre-reflective, we don't know. And this wonderful, we don't know, this is not a scary, I know it seems scary to you guys, but if you stay with your meditation, you'll see that it's within that darkness, there's incredible light, incredible life, incredible lightness. And it helps our reflection, too. Helps our reflection. So, whole being Buddha nature. Whole being Buddha nature. So that's what I want to say for this morning. And I'll be glad to entertain questions or comments. Or some Easter story, or whatever. My, I'm going to say something. So my grandkids who live in France dyed Easter eggs. No, they dyed them 7 hours ago. My wife brought them over. Let's see, what did she bring over? She brought them over in her suitcase because the French are not into this. And so they were dyeing Easter eggs. Probably the only kids in the neighborhood dyeing Easter eggs. That's just what I'm sharing. That's all. I want you to all know about my grandkids. If I can't think of any stories, I have to make one up. Because I'm attached. I'm attached. As we all are. So, comments? Questions?
Can you offer some differentiation between acknowledging that we are making up the stories, the religions, the mythology, and hubris, and believing that we as humans are creating the world?
Can I acknowledge that? Can I do what?
Is there anything about the difference between those things?
Well, of course, there's a huge difference between them. A huge difference. Well, all I can say is that we get attached to some reflections, and those reflections become deeply seated beliefs. And within the reflective mode, we can see that. We can see that, and then we can let go of it within the pre-reflective mode. But most religion is so tamped down, even Buddhism, that that kind of reflection is not very allowable. You're sinful, or you're not following Buddha's way, or something. But that kind of reflection is very important, reflecting on how we get wedded to our way of being, and But we can lighten it up too by pre-reflection, which is just let go of the whole thing and just return to this. Just return to this. And we really need both, because reflection by itself will not lighten up. It just doesn't. I used to be a Unitarian, and Unitarians are good. But without, maybe they're starting to do pre-reflection now, but my Unitarian church, they didn't. Because they got all messed up. They got all messed up. I apologize to Unitarians. This is my Unitarianism, my childhood. Because they... Do you understand? Did I make it clear, or do you have something more?
It's more and more. What's pre-reflection? What's before what we make? That's what I'm asking.
What's before we make up?
Before what we as humans make up.
What's before? Well,
can we reflect on that? Is there points that we can't reflect upon?
Well, when we... Yes. We need to return to pre-reflection. We need to let go of reflection. We can reflect on the reflection, which reflects on the reflection, but at some point, we need to just return to original stillness. Let it all... just go its own way. Go its own way and return to the thisness of being here together. The thisness of being here together without reflecting on it. Just being it. Just being it. But you're right. There's a meta. And we go on and on and on. But at some point, we just need to stop. Return to this. I mean, Wittgenstein, you guys know this, I've talked about this before. Wittgenstein studied Western philosophy a lot for a long time. And then he finally said, you've heard me say this lots of times, Stacy, he finally said, the wonder is not that things are, or why they are, or how they are, but that they are. That they are. That's the wonder. That's pre-reflection. That they are, but they are not. No difference in pre-reflection.
I hit bedrock and my spade is tuned.
Pardon?
That's what he said. I hit bedrock and my spade is tuned.
Oh, well, good for you. Good for you. Yes, I hit bedrock and my spade is tuned. Great. He should teach a class in Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein's pretty cool, you know.
I had to live with a couple of philosophy graduate students for a couple of years when I was in college. And one time, one woke me up at 3 o'clock in the morning and said, if I ask you, do you know how to spell river, and you say R-I-V-E-R, is that a correct answer? And I said, sure. And he said, no, he was asking me about a state of knowledge. Let's pull a book out.
So were you impulsive or pre-reflective?
All.
All being Buddha nature. Anything more? Yeah.
How do you commit to a family member or a friend or a cause or a romantic relationship without forming those attachment relationships? How do you commit to something potentially for the rest of your life, like a job or a relationship or a family member, without becoming attached and possessive of that relationship?
Well, you do become attached, and you do become possessive. It doesn't matter how much zazen you do. But doesn't matter if you're the Roshi beyond compare. You're attached and you're possessive. But if you could just... What?
I suppose my question then is, what is the healthy way to approach that?
The healthy way is to see your attachments in the reflective mode, to see how they're causing problems, to see how they're blinding your vision, and to try to modify that to the degree you can, and then finally, but more importantly, to completely accept that. And when you completely accept that, some of the clinging falls away. It falls away. That's in the reflective mode, but in the non-reflective mode, it all falls away. Because on our cushions, we let go of all of it. And it only takes, again, this sounds like some big deal, but it only takes a 60th of a second of space between your thought to feel that spaciousness where the attachment is completely gone. It comes back, but once you let it completely go, when it comes back, it's not so powerful. Once you completely let it go again and again and again, when it comes back, it's more loving and not so kind. It's still attached. You still cry when you the person you love falls down, but you don't make a federal case out of it. You just cry. Just cry. Anything more? Yeah.
I think pre-reflection and reflection are like breathing in and breathing out.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
That's what I think.
That's your reflection. I like that reflection. I like it. Any more reflections? Or pre-reflections, as the case may be?
Dean. I do have one. So I was kind of really listening into what you were saying, Stacey. So...
He's going to answer you.
No. It's a question.
Yeah, sure.
So... Like most of us, you know, I'm from a Western background, and I do some work in engineering, so I come kind of from a scientific process background.
Yeah.
So we have a scientific method, and that's a perception, or that's where it reflects you. That's a way of looking at things. But in having that work through, we see that if we follow that, outcomes are repeatable over and over and over if we follow certain principles.
Mm-hmm.
So is it delusional to, you know, do you look at it and say, you know, from a pre-reflective or reflective mode, well, you know, the scientific is just another one of those instances, but yet it seems to work out over and over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the deal with all that? Right? Are there certain types of perceptions or reflections that seem to... align with the actual pattern that, you know, whether it's an animal or a human or a dog or a bird or stars in the galaxy, you know.
Yeah, so he's arguing for the validity of the scientific method. In a way, you are. You're arguing for that. I mean, indirectly.
I mean, it doesn't have to be scientific method. It could be something else, but are there certain things that seem to work out?
Well, there are. I mean, look at all the Buddhist practice we have. We have a look at these people that I gave transmission to. They went through, they did this, they did that, they did the other. It was all orderly. It was based on what had been done for hundreds of years. may not have always been orderly inside, but we try to make it orderly. It's a pattern. It's a pattern that's been passed down from generation to generation, just like science has been passed down within the West from generation to generation. It's a pattern. Right?
So certain patterns may not just be delusional. They may actually have something solid, going back to that, my spade is turned thing.
All right. Yeah, but if we get if I get too attached to the pattern that I put these people through, then I think it's the one true way, and I'm not open to your pattern. And so I can get just as attached to it. I have this feeling that my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, I have this feeling that he's always with me. I just have this feeling. You know, he's been dead for years and years. I have this feeling. But if I turn that into a big belief system, or think that I've got something that you guys don't have, that you maybe get if you hang around with me, then that's not cool. That's not cool.
So it's maybe almost a little, I mean, not to get too tied in with philosophy, but a little bit like Schoenberg's thing with the perceivers altering
yes.
what is perceived.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yes, this guy. So you should teach a course here on Zen and science. Okay, I think that's enough for today, and I'll turn it over to Laura.